Thank you for being here. And we'd like to make this as intimate as possible. And by all means, if you have questions, ask them. Don't need to wait until the end. And I'm going to do something that I don't often have a chance to do because we have more time today. And normally I'm asked to speak for like 10 minutes, and it's hard to capture 10 minutes of, in 10 minutes, you know, 10 years of the work we've been doing on equal access to public resources in the context of parks, schools, and human health. But today we have more time, and I would really like to focus on the aspect of translating social science research into systemic change. In other words, how we take the social science evidence-based research and use that in the legal context, either in court or out of court, to achieve change. And this is a very important question to us because there is such a focus on the need for evidence-based social science research to address the kind of issues you all know about, the relationship between physical activity and healthy and good health, reducing obesity, healthy eating and good health, access to parks and reducing obesity, physical education in schools. There's so much research going on in those areas. And the health foundations, including the California Endowment and George Flores, who's one of our funders, have a huge amount of money invested in that, and that's good. And as I say, a central theme of the talk today will be how to translate that into policy, law, and systemic change. But as we say at the City Project, as attorneys, we have to prove what we all know is true. Because when we started this work 10 to 15 years ago, there was not this tsunami of social science research on physical activity, healthy eating, and the built environment. Indeed, frankly, nobody took us seriously when we presented the blueprint for what I thought would be a one-year project, and it's been now 10 to 12 years. And in fact, we went to the endowment at the time and explained to them what we planned to do, and we got a one-letter response saying we don't fund soccer programs. And we went to the national civil rights organizations, and MALDEF, for example, said, physical education is not a priority. Education is our priority. And I said, education includes physical education. And they said, well, we can repeat what we just said, but we're not going to get involved in this. And we went to the mainstream environmental organizations, and I did a presentation before the board of directors of a national organization, and one of the board members said, what do parks have to do with the environment? So when we started on this, it wasn't perceived as a civil rights issue. It wasn't perceived as a health issue. It was not perceived as an environmental issue. Was not perceived as an environmental justice issue because the environmental justice movement traditionally has stopped bad things like toxic sites from happening in communities of color. And we are pushing the envelope of environmental justice by proactively creating good things like parks and schools. So this photograph is very important for several reasons. Again, as attorneys, everything I do is evidence-based. That's what attorneys do. And I am a recovering litigator. I can file lawsuits, and we have filed lawsuits. We prefer not to, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But when we start a problem, working on a problem, we start with something like this, and that's the reality of children's lives. And so 10, 12 years ago, 15 years ago, we knew children in Los Angeles, children of color in Los Angeles, did not have enough places to play, not in parks, not in schools, not anywhere. So we start with the reality of people's lives, first of all. Second, this photograph is actually taken by a 13-year-old girl. Her name is at the top there, Celeste Lopez, I believe, 13-year-old girl. And it was part of a wonderful project called Picturing Health. It was done by Venice Arts, but it was funded by the endowment. And I also want to be clear, I didn't pick these images because they're funded by the endowment. The endowment just happens to be doing the cutting edge work in this area, along with several of our other funders. But this project, Picturing Health, this these children were told, teens in high schools were told, here's a camera, go out and fix your health. And this 13-year-old girl knew, without looking at social science evidence, without looking at all that, knew that health is playing, physical activity, playing soccer. She knew there are no places to play. And so that picture captures a reality. And it is our job as lawyers to make that reality relevant to decision makers. Whether in or out of court, we start with that reality and we have to translate the reality of people's lives into systemic change. We've had some success. This is what is now known as Los Angeles State Historic Park at the Cornfield, because the major areas we've been working on are, first of all, equal access to parks and recreation, including urban parks, and that is in the heart of downtown Los Angeles. A second major area we work on is education, including physical education. First of all, through building schools, new schools in underserved areas. Second, joint use of schools, pools, and parks, as in this example. And third, enforcing physical education requirements in public schools. Over half the school districts in California don't enforce physical education laws. There was an article in the New York Times about 10 days ago about school districts throughout the nation that don't enforce physical education laws, and we're enforcing them. And I'll come back to that. But those three things, equal access to parks and recreation, quality education, including physical education, and the related human health issues. And we define human health broadly, and we're happy to see that WHO, the World Health Organization, does as well. Because as we've told, for example, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, there is more to public health than reducing obesity. They've declared that by 2015 they will stop and reverse childhood obesity. That's not good enough for us, because you could have, in principle, a lot of skinny black kids doing life without parole for being being shooters in drive-by shootings, and that would be measured as a success under the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation standard, but not under ours, because public health includes reducing obesity, but also the full development of the child. Physically fit students do better academically. We consider violence a public health issue, so after-school programs, team sports, and so on, provide positive alternatives for gangs, crimes, drugs, and violence. All the things you all know are true. And again, we've been doing this work for about 10 to 15 years now, but we were actually inspired by the Olmsted vision. Frederick Law Olmsted was the man who created the field of landscape architecture. He designed and created Central Park in New York City. That was his first park. He said Prospect Park in Brooklyn was his best park. I disagree. I think Central Park is the finest park in the nation. I still consider it my neighborhood park. But his sons, in 1930, in this plan, did a proposal for Los Angeles called Parks, Playgrounds, and Beaches for the Los Angeles Region. And they proposed a comprehensive web of parks, of schools with 5 acres or more of playing fields, and transportation to unite everything. And that was their vision. And again, it wasn't based on social science research. It wasn't based on the modern civil rights movement. It wasn't based on the modern environmental movement. It was simply a good idea. And these men, through their genius, drove around LA and with pen and paper, noted all the places where the parks should be, all the schools with 5 acres, put it together in a map, published the map, published the report, and the report came out in 1930 at the height of the Great Depression, and so it basically was stillborn. It went nowhere for about 80 years, but we took it, and using the descriptions they did, driving around with pen and pencil, our GIS mappers entered that data, geocoded it, and generated the map, which matches almost exactly with what they did by hand in 1930. So the technology has advanced, the social science has advanced, but we're really back to this vision. For example, they proposed joint use of schools, pools, and parks. It's something that's gotten a lot of traction in California in the last 2 or 3 years. But it's not rocket science, it's just common sense. It's what creates good communities. As I said, this was our flagship project. When we started this in 2000, The city of Los Angeles and a wealthy developer were proposing putting in 32 acres of warehouses in the last vast open space in downtown Los Angeles with no environmental review and no community participation. And ultimately, we prevailed, and today that is Los Angeles State Historic Park. It could have been warehouses. Instead, it's a park. The LA Times called this victory a heroic monument and a symbol of hope. And we use the strategies that I'll talk about to convert. That is the cornfield, an abandoned rail yard for 10 years in downtown LA, to convert that into the park. The central strategies that we've learned, not just from the city projects work, but from our prior work at the Legal Defense Fund on equal access to public resources, because that is the deep legal view of what we do, is first of all, community organizing and coalition building. Second, translating research into policy law and social change. Third, strategic media campaigns, and I'll go over each of these in more detail. Fourth, policy and legal advocacy outside the courts. And finally, five, when necessary, we will go to court. And we don't call it litigation because foundations don't fund litigation. We call it access to justice through the courts. And as I say, this is what I'd like to go into in more detail today because we have a little bit more time. The work on equal access to public resources, from our perspective, the legal framework is provided by Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and its regulations, which in a nutshell says it is illegal for recipients of federal funds to engage either in intentional discrimination or in unjustified discriminatory impacts. And that's basically the way the law is framed, written. If you state it in positive terms, which the United States Department of Transportation has done, it requires that, first of all, a recipient of federal funding or an applicant for federal funding provide a clear description of a proposed project, which includes policies, programs, plans, anything. Second, that in the process of seeking the funding and implementing that, they analyze the impact on all people, including people of color and low-income people. Third, they analyze alternatives to the project or proposal. Four, they include minorities and low-income populations in the decision-making process. And fifth, they have an equity plan to address any concerns identified during that process. And again, that's a positive way of framing it, and the Department of Transportation has done exactly that. The way the law is written and the way we normally raise these issues, if we go to court, for example, is through the discriminatory impact standard. There are three issues. One, are there numerical disparities in access, for example, to parks? Two, is there any business necessity that justifies those disparities? And three, are there less discriminatory alternatives to accomplish the same goal? And I'll illustrate this in a moment. That's what is the so-called discriminatory impact standard, and intent is not relevant. It's simply the effect of the project. The harder way to prove intentional discrimination is through intentional discrimination. And in the 21st century, you're not going to find very often signs anymore that say in a park, whites only. And the United States Supreme Court has recognized that. And the Supreme Court has laid out these six types of evidence. One, are there numerical disparities, which is like the question of discriminatory impacts. And the Supreme Court, again, in terms of what evidence will work, the Supreme Court has held you can use anecdotal evidence, like the picture of the little boy, or affidavits from people who don't have access to parks. Social scientists tend to dismiss anecdotal evidence because, as somebody put it to me, with anecdotal evidence, you have an N of one. But the Supreme Court has recognized anecdotal evidence is valid. And second, statistical studies. So one, are there numerical disparities? Two, is there a history of discrimination? Three, are there substantive irregularities in reaching the decision? So that in the cornfield, for example, you would expect a park there because LA is park poor rather than warehouses. We argued that was a substantive irregularity for the city to have agreed to put a warehouse there. Four, are there procedural irregularities? Again, in the cornfield context, there was no environmental review. you would expect the last vast open space in downtown LA to entail environmental review. We argued that was a procedural irregularity. Five, do officials know of the impact on people of color? We make it our job to tell them. And six, is there a pattern in practice of discrimination, which pretty much encompasses all of the above? So those are that's the legal framework. And often when I do presentations, I only use the slides, the images, because people will remember the images and it's a much more emotional impact. But in fact, this is the deep legal framework of everything we do. And to illustrate each of the strategies, first of all, community organizing and coalition building. Seth Strongen is here. He's the assistant director of the City Project. We have 8 FTEs at the City Project. We don't ourselves go out and knock on doors, do telephone, what are they called?
Phone banking.
We don't do that. We don't have the staff. But we rely on allies like the Anahuac Youth Soccer Association or Concerned Citizens of South Central Los Angeles. They have thousands of members. When we need that kind of direct organizing, we write the scripts, we meet with them, and they go ahead and do the phone banking. They present, they bring busloads of students to speak at council hearings and so on. At a higher level, we do coalition building. We bring non-traditional partners to the table on issues like parks and education. Latino Coalition for a Healthy California is one of those non-traditional allies that regularly support our work. Carmen doesn't like this, but Cardinal Roger Mahoney and the Archdiocese of Los Angeles supported our work for the Los Angeles State Historic Park at the Cornfield. So, but this is the single most important lesson we've learned is community organizing and coalition building, because ultimately nobody cares what we think. There's only 8 of us. We're just attorneys. To the extent that we have any impact, it's because of the people we represent, the allies we work with, the constituents that we work with, the people who vote, the people that the elected officials will listen to. Second, we do extensive research. And as I say, there's a lot of social science research going on, a lot of funding for it. This report was published about 30 days ago. It looks at the 9 counties of Southern California. It's available on our website. If you go to our website, there's a button that says Map Justice. You click on it and you'll get to this report. And for 9 counties of Southern California, we analyze it at the census tract level. We have documented the same pattern in every county. Children of color living in poverty with no access to a car have the worst access to parks, the worst access to schools with 5 acres or more of playing fields or that teach physical education. They have the highest levels of childhood obesity, and they suffer disproportionately from risky behavior like gangs, crime, drugs, and violence. So when the Supreme Court says, are there numerical disparities? This is our statistical study. This is our anecdotal evidence. There's photographs. This is the kind of evidence the court is talking about. We've done the same thing for the entire state of California at the mapping level. We haven't yet written policy reports. Our goal, if we can get some more funding from the endowment and others, George, is to do a report on the central California and on northern California, that we have mapped the entire state. What this map shows, the red hatched hotspots, are 3 things. 1, communities that are park poor. 2, communities that are income poor. And 3, communities that are disproportionately of color. And we actually helped define the legislation in California that defines park poor as less than 3 acres of parks per 1,000 residents, and income poor as below $47,331 median household income. And that's one of our biggest policy victories, because those standards provide measurable standards to measure progress, to measure equity, and to hold public officials accountable in devoting resources, public resources, to the most underserved community in terms of physical activity and healthy eating. So that, again, is responsive to the Supreme Court's call for analysis of numerical disparities. It's responsive to the kind of social science research that's being done on whether there's correlation between physical activity, access to parks, and obesity. The history of discrimination. We went back to the time Los Angeles and California joined the Union. Los Angeles pioneered the use of racially discriminatory housing covenants. So the patterns in LA, as I say, if there are parks, there are very few people of color. If there are people of color, there are very few parks. That's not an accident of unplanned growth. That's not a product of a free market in land allocating green space efficiently based on utilitarian preferences. That is the continuing history and legacy and pattern of discrimination in mortgage policies, discrimination in land use policies. The federal government would not subsidize home mortgages except in racially homogenous neighborhoods. This is openly what Los Angeles was like throughout much of the 20th century. The California Supreme Court upheld racially restrictive covenants. It wasn't until the United States Supreme Court in the 1940s and 50s held they are unconstitutional and unenforceable that things began to change. So that's the kind of research we rely on: GIS mapping, demographic analysis, the history of discrimination, the social science research. The third strategy is media campaigns. As I say, the LA Times, we have traditionally relied on the LA Times editorials and articles. More and more we rely on new media. This is a 9-minute segment that KCET, the public television station in Los Angeles, produced about 2 weeks ago. You can go to our website and see the link and view it. It's funded by the endowment through KCET, not through us. So having that on the web is an example of a new media strategy. And in those 9 minutes, you can, I think, learn more than in my talk here today, because it's not just us. It talks to the people, to the children, to a historian. They did a just fantastic job. But also you'll see the buttons for Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and so on. We rely on all those strategies to spread the word about our work. Fourth strategy, policy and legal advocacy outside the courts. Mariah LaFleur is here from Sarah Samuels and Associates. She and Seth at 2:30 this afternoon will be doing a poster presentation on this campaign. As I mentioned earlier, over half the school districts in California don't enforce physical education requirements. We started a campaign in 2007, and ultimately by 2009, the end of 2009, the Los Angeles Unified School District, without litigation, because of the advocacy campaign and legal campaign, agreed to adopt a physical education plan, both under the education code. The education code says schools have to provide 20 minutes of PE in elementary schools, 40 minutes in middle and high school. LAUC agreed to adopt a plan under the education code, but also under the civil rights laws to provide PE. And the civil rights argument that we made tracks everything that I've told you in terms of numerical disparities, no justification for those disparities, no justification for not providing PE, a history of discrimination in providing public education in California and in Los Angeles. The decision makers knew about it, and so on. We just published this study with Sarah Samuels and Associates. We've received a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to monitor compliance with the education plan and to study the impact on physical education. We just published this a week ago, or even 4 days ago. And it's very interesting to us. We have received more funding to study the impact of our work than we receive for taking action itself, because there is so much funding for social science research and so little funding for taking legal action. But it's a wonderful report. Mariah and Seth will be talking about it today at 2:30. And finally, the fifth strategy, access to justice and democracy through the courts. This is the Los Angeles River. Many people don't know there is an LA River, even if you grew up in LA. It's 52 miles long. It goes from San Fernando Valley to Long Beach. And in the 1930 Olmsted Report, they recommended the greening of the Los Angeles River. Instead, in the 1930s, the Army Corps of Engineers drowned the entire river in a sea of concrete for flood control purposes, to get the water through the river as quickly as possible. Today it's one of the most environmentally degraded rivers in the world. The large square toward the center left is known as Taylor Yard, an abandoned rail yard for about a decade. using the same campaign strategies that I just outlined here, it is now Tres de Los Angeles State Park at Taylor Yard, and it triggered an urban revitalization plan for the Los Angeles River. It includes soccer fields. Those are the children of the Anahuac Youth Soccer Association, our clients and allies. It includes natural green space. It's a best practice example of a balanced urban park that includes active recreation as well as passive recreation. That's something we did not anticipate when we started these campaigns. There is actually a division. Mainstream enviros, for the most part, will support passive recreation, but they will not support active recreation. We had to threaten a lawsuit against the California Department of Parks and Recreation in order for them to put in the soccer fields at Taylor Yard, because the California State Department of Parks and Recreation said, we do wilderness parks. We said, this is downtown LA. There's no wilderness in downtown LA. They said, yeah, but our rangers are law enforcement officers. They carry guns. They don't carry clipboards and whistles. They don't referee soccer games. We said, we're not asking your rangers to referee the games. We'll referee the games. You just put in the flat green space. And it really did require the threat of a lawsuit. There's also a playground there. We're very proud of this page. It is a page from President Obama's report called America's Great Outdoors, published in 2010. It features Tres de Los Angeles State Park. The New York Times architecture critic has called Tres de Los Angeles State Park and the greening of the LA River a best practice example for cities across the nation to revitalize urban areas. We're very proud of that. However, in the report by President Obama, first of all, it doesn't mention a word that it took a lawsuit to make this park happen. And second, it does not address access based on race, color, national origin, and poverty. They use the euphemism of underserved communities, but they will not directly address race, color, national origin, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In some ways, it has become harder for us to achieve civil rights victories now that there is a black man in the White House. That's one of the contradictions that we have to work with as civil rights lawyers. The LA River, much of the LA River looks like that. Those are girls sunbathing on a concrete beach along the river. And the goal is to revitalize that with green space. One other example, very briefly, of litigation. This is the Baldwin Hills Park, the largest urban park designed in the United States in over a century. It adjoins an active oil field. It took us 3 years of litigation before the County of Los Angeles agreed, number one, to improve the oil field regulations to better protect human health and the environment, and number two, to do periodic health studies on the impact of the oil fields on the park and the residents. And they agreed to do those health studies both under traditional health standards, but also under the civil rights laws that I outlined here today. This is very relevant. Two weeks ago, the National Research Council published a book called Health Impact Assessment. It's a wonderful book. It provides a framework that looks very much like the equal justice framework that I outlined in my very early in this presentation. And again, it was disappointing because the National Research Council described how to do a health impact assessment under the National Environmental Policy Act, but they ignored how do you do an analysis of health disparities under the civil rights laws. So we're going to be working with Dr. Dick Jackson, who was the head of that committee, to include that in a separate policy report. The values at stake. The way we bring people together, diverse alliances, non-traditional partners, is again, we don't focus just on one issue like reducing childhood obesity. We have about 20 sets of values. One, human health and development, which goes beyond obesity, as I say, to include academic performance and reducing violence as a health issue. Two, conservation values of clean air, clean water, clean land, climate justice, which is an equity perspective on global warming. Three, cultural and spiritual values. And I'll show that in a moment. Economic vitality, jobs and justice, and then the cross-cutting values. Our mission is equal justice, democracy, and livability for all. cultural values, that is one of the frames from the Great Wall of Los Angeles, the world's longest mural, half mile long. It tells the history of Los Angeles and California from the perspective of people of color. It is actually in the LA River on one of the walls. It's been recently restored. That shows one way parks are promote cultural and spiritual values. Another way is many Native American sacred sites are located in parks. And we worked with the Native Americans in San Diego to stop a toll road through San Onofre State Beach. The toll road would have devastated the state beach, which is a park, and also devastated the 9,000-year-old sacred site that is located there. And the commissioner, one of the commissioners of the California Coastal Commission, explicitly stated after the Native Americans sang this prayer that the impact on Native Americans alone was reason enough to stop the toll road. They're singing a prayer on my left. You can see me. That's a photograph from the LA Times. They didn't include me because I wasn't singing. My elementary school chorus choir teacher would be so disappointed. Jobs. If you want parks, work for jobs and justice. Again, this is at Anahuac, at Rio Los Angeles State Park, the children themselves planting the trees in the balanced natural park. But it's an example of the Civilian Conservation Corps programs, type programs, that President Obama and the United States government could be using now. During the New Deal, the Civilian Conservation Corps and Public Works Administration built over 8,000 parks. They built over 40,000 schools. CCC alone created 3 million jobs. Visitors to national parks went up 600% during the years of the Civilian Conservation Corps. That's a best practice example for what the nation could be doing today, but it's not doing that today. That's it. Thank you very much. Yes. Do you want to do the questions now or wait?
I don't know.
However
you want.
Do I get to decide?
Yes.
Let's do this. Why don't we take about 5 minutes of questions now, and then George, and then we'll just kind of throw them all into the pot and see what kind of conversation gets started.
Robert, you invited a question.
Yes.
You made a comment.
Yes.
About the Obama administration.
Yes.
And it kind of suggests that that the current Attorney General,
Eric Holder,
is the respective division that would deal with these kinds of issues, is not being aggressive enough in this arena.
Yes. The current Attorney General, Eric Holder, of the United States is not being aggressive enough in enforcing civil rights laws. Absolutely, I agree with that, first of all. Second, it is not just up to the United States Justice Department, because having been a federal prosecutor, there simply are not enough Justice Department attorneys to enforce the laws across the nation. Every department should be enforcing the civil rights laws. They are all charged with ensuring that if they give a grant, they have to make sure that the recipient signs an agreement not to engage in intentional discrimination or discriminatory impacts. The number one reaction we get when we go to federal agencies, state agencies, regional, local agencies, when we say we'd like to talk to you about park access and Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the number one reaction we get is, what's Title VI? People don't know it's the law. Federal agencies don't know it's the law. Federal agencies don't know how to enforce the law. There are high-level meetings going on at this moment with the United States Environmental Protection Agency down the street. US EPA, I think, has a backlog of over 10 years of environmental justice complaints that it has not investigated, and they're trying to figure out how to investigate them, how to prioritize them, but also how do you analyze these issues. I've just shown how to analyze them. It's not rocket science, but Department of Interior and the National Park Service, John Jarvis spoke yesterday. We are part of the roundtable on Healthy Parks, Healthy People US, which Director Jarvis has initiated. We're very happy to work with him on that. that we have consistently pressed him to explicitly analyze the Title VI implications of the grants they give and the programs they support, and that has not been forthcoming. As I said, the America's Great Outdoors publication, we repeatedly stressed you need to look at explicitly the disparities based on race, color, and national origin. America's Great Outdoors campaign has not done that. To put all this in a charitable light, I think the administration and the agencies feel if we explicitly address disparities based on race, color, and national origin, it will alienate the right wing, and then the Republicans and the Tea Party won't work with us on access to parks. And you know, one response to that is just look at the evidence. The United States Census did a study called A Child's Day about 2 years ago, and the Census Bureau documents that in urban areas, close to half of Latinos, like 48% of Latino families, do not let their children play outside because of the perception that there's no safe place to play, compared to about, I think, 33% of non-Hispanic white folks. So look at the data. That is one reason why the social science data is so important. That's one reason why the health community is so important, because the health community looks at the data regardless of ideology and looks at those race disparities and says, you know, we don't care about ideology, but people are dying from obesity, and we need to do something about it, and Latino children and black children suffer disproportionately from diabetes and obesity. And that message has to penetrate the agency heads and the White House. Yes. It's like they say in Texas, it ain't bragging if you can do it. We're doing it. We agree it's cutting-edge work. We don't know if anybody else is doing it. One. Two, we are very grateful to Carmen and APHA because last year when we received the President's Award for helping to make public health a social justice imperative, that was the major award we have received. That is the major mainstream recognition that we've received that this work is, in fact, capable of changing, of achieving systemic change. Third, we're very grateful to George and the California Endowment for funding this work because, again, 10 years ago, they did not see the value of what we were proposing. Since 2006, the California Endowment has been a major funder. So I think, yes, it's growing. As I mentioned earlier, MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund, 10, 12 years ago would not work with us on this. They said this is not a civil rights priority. They've received a major grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to address childhood obesity and diabetes. That's good. And we welcome more allies to the table. One risk is, you know, why didn't the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation fund our work? I think it's because of the perception that we're not a national organization, and they fund national organizations. We like to think of ourselves as like the Navy SEALs. We're special forces. We go in first. We make the area safe for conventional forces, and the conventional forces go in, and we're at the next horizon. So we like to be 3 to 5 years or more ahead of the cutting edge. But that is the next step now, is with the national civil rights organizations beginning to get it, beginning to get funding, with the national foundations beginning to fund this. I think Public Health Institute has an opportunity to address this. APHA should continue to address this. And that's what I meant by the single most important lesson we've learned is not just community organizing at the grassroots level, but coalition building at the state, national, and international level. 10 days ago, the Rio statement came out from WHO, World Health Organization, on the politics of addressing the social determinants of health. And it lays out an agenda, which could be our agenda for the next 5 to 10 years.
So real quickly, Carol, just because I want to give George a chance to speak and then we can have an even fuller conversation. There are a lot of opportunities within this association to bring different segments of the organization together in some kind of an umbrella sort of thinking way, and this annual meeting is a great place in which to do it. I mean, we're all here together, and people are trying to find new ways of thinking about things. And I think that really, when I first got what Robert and his group were doing, it seemed to me a new slice, a sort of a new take, another take on how do we get to where we need to go. Bringing the other people whose work and resources could really make our work even more impactful happen better. So I think that this is a really good place to do it. We start planning now for a major event at the next meeting and who those other partners are. So, George, you want to go ahead and take the mic? Right
up there. Yes. Reach.
Good afternoon. Following a litigator is a bit intimidating. Makes you feel like you better say the right thing or there will be consequences. So, Robert, please, be kind. This topic, translating research into social change, is certainly something upon which we've not only founded our work in public health, but has really been the inspiration for a lot of ethnic groups to come forward, African-American, Hispanic, Asian groups, groups on behalf of people of alternative lifestyles, gay, lesbian, people from other, even other occupations to come forward and be able to challenge the status quo and say, we have the right, we have the not only the right, but in some sense, responsibility to represent our background, our beliefs, our value systems, and find in public health a place where we can create the kind of change that we want to see in the world. We want the world to be the kind of place that we want to raise our children, we want to grow old in, we want to live in. And it really is about a deep sense of making things the right way. And what is so challenging in these times, these political times, and these economic times too, is the amount of divisiveness now there is in society, splitting people apart along fractured lines of social discord now, people against people about whether they really do have a right to address these deep needs in society, if they cost anything, if they might mean raising taxes, if they go against an ideology that doesn't permit some people to think under those in those terms. And so where we are in Washington, D.C. right now is really kind of prophetic in a way that this conversation is one that must be had, that we must find ourselves in this kind of milieu so that we can come up with the solutions. Because the reality is our society cannot go the way that Congress is going right now, where people simply will not deal with each other from an ideological standpoint, that we do have to find a way to put into practice what we know is not only the right thing to do, but it's proven in research, proven in practice to work and to make a difference and to be the kinds of changes that will make things better, that we will have, prevent diseases from happening, we'll prevent injuries from happening, people will grow up healthier, higher levels of educational achievement. All of the things about human productivity can come to bear if we put into practice what we know. When we're thwarted and when we're kept from doing that, it becomes discouraging in a sense, but in another sense, it's the big challenge before us, and that's why we're here in a meeting like this, to find those kinds of answers. So, that said, we know that public health as a field has been informed by years and years of medical research, and in fact, perhaps more so than social sciences research when it comes down to it. And in fact, we see in terms of what gets funded gets done. What gets funded in the world of the National Institutes of Health, for example, is biomedical research that, if you know Frieden's triangle or pyramid, it is mostly what's at the top, what would get treated with drugs or surgery or procedures to make more money for a biomedical industry, without nearly enough attention toward the bottom of the pyramid as to what will keep people healthy, which is basically the social sciences, economic, educational research that feeds into how will people become healthier. So that's a challenge before us, to try to turn that paradigm around and have research, because we need that evidence base, change the dialogue, change the reality around what kinds of research get funded in this country so that it can drive even greater changes like what Robert is talking about. Because the more evidence we have, the more social research, the stronger research in more places and more situations, we'll be able to defeat the arguments that continually pop up that where is the evidence, how much will this save us, you really don't, you know, this is really your opinion rather than fact. Whether or not the argument would win the day, because the bottom line in many cases really isn't logic or science, it happens to do with ideology. But still, we need the information and we need the evidence, because we who deal with truth have to go forward with that, so best we can stand on. Tools that are giving us the opportunity to get into this area include a health impact assessment. This is a new report by the Institute of Medicine now gives us a solid grounding to stand on and say that there are standards behind health impact assessment, and showing that this particular tool is allowing us to take a look at policies, and not only the policy, not only the options in a policy decision that relate to health from a medical standpoint, but health from a socioeconomic, demographic, social standpoint. So you can bring into a health impact assessment even public opinion surveys. You can bring in environmental assessment information. You can bring in educational and demographic and economic information into the equation to help them make a decision that will be more cognizant of the impact on people's health and well-being in the long run, our way of life, and those policy impacts really need to be determined on in those realms, because without that, there could be mistakes made or oversight, which is what has happened in the past that has resulted in so much freeways being built and suburbs being splattered all over the land site, economic disadvantages, job concentrations in certain areas and not others. These are the kinds of things that a health impact assessment at least can make the decision makers aware of before that decision becomes either a default or a decision or a bad decision. And then the public has the responsibility of hearing the arguments and considering them as well, and making sure that the kinds of decision makers they want representing them are there and hearing all of the considerations. So we are using new tools like a health impact assessment to look more deeply at issues like the social, economic, environmental, educational determinants of health. Another point that I'd like to make is that public health is grounded in social justice. It's not a reminder, it's a fact. And it comes from a historical role in our greatest dreams around sanitation and housing and workplace conditions, but moves on to really explaining the underlying reasons of inequities, persisting disparities in health status that trouble us, that seem to confound us because we haven't been able to really make nearly enough progress on the front of changing those gaps over the years. And we've called it different names and tried to change the statistics and even had programs aimed in that direction. But truly, we will not get to the point of true equity until we start addressing those underlying conditions, including racism, including opportunity at the very clearest outset around economic opportunity and social status. Those are the kinds of opportunities that create a true America where there is equality and equal rights and equal justice. And it's what really is the foundation of what the City Project does and argues on behalf of, so that we can give people, no matter where you're born, what place, or what color is your skin, or what language you speak, if you're an American, if you're in America, you have the same opportunity as the person next to you, the same opportunity as the person of another color, another language, another social background. These are the kinds of justice factors that we all believe deeply in and must continue to drive for. And this is why it's so important for us then to celebrate when we have wins, we have an organization that can put into practice that kind of approach and that kind of belief system, which is the foundation of America. And it's finally saying, look, this is why we were established as a nation, so this is what we must do to carry out that mantra, that not only mantra, but actually that constitutional charge. This is why we were founded, and we believe that we are the true Americans in doing so, and not at all the outsiders in this discourse. So social change has been manifest in programs that the California Endowment has enjoyed supporting over the years. Some of them harken back to days where we were working with public health departments and communities together and matured into work that maybe came under the topical area of childhood obesity prevention, but working closely with communities, together with government, across sectors, and using a multi-phasic, multi-level approach that always included community as the driver of change. That is the essential element. We have to be a power builder, because really in the places where the health matters the most, where people need to address those inequities the most, those are the people that have traditionally been the least empowered. And so we need to change that power dynamic by giving them the tools they need and the information they need in order to take their rightful place in decision-making, in collaboration, and being a driver of the kinds of change they want to see in their communities. So we are approaching our big initiative in 14 places in the state, plus the statewide work and even the national work that the California Endowment funds. It's called Building Healthy Communities, and it's based on all four primary steps. One is building that capacity or building power in communities. And the second one is changing the dialogue or communication, changing the conversation from people thinking that health comes from medical care only, or it comes from a pill bottle, or that social justice is some silly notion of a left-winger. And instead, we change that into this real dialogue that I have just been telling you about, where this approach of ours is nothing strange. It is the basic foundation upon which our nation was built and our belief systems were built, and really is in the best interest of all of us here in this state of California or this nation as a whole. Because when our weakest link suffers, it's been a metaphor and allegory after allegory about when your weakest link fails, that's when the whole chain fails. And in truth, when whether it's with infectious disease, or with a failing student that goes on to become a prisoner, that goes on to become a burden on society, we have to take care of all of us, and we're all in this together. So our real capacity is in building up all of us. So that is part of changing the conversation we use, telling stories from the communities we use, bringing forward this kind of conversation into the public. And we try to get it in even to op-eds and testimony before Congress, before the state legislature. We feel that we need to think differently as a society, and our society has been inculcated far too long into thinking the wrong way about people in poor communities, or thinking about justice as being something where you punish people rather than provide opportunity for people to do much better and not even have to enter the justice system in the first place. The third thing we do is create alliances. And we believe that it's important not to do this in isolation or think that you're the only element in society that cares about this or is an agent that can make change. You really do have to join hands with other groups, and especially other sectors, even to the extent of getting some of your people that you would not think of your allies as being involved. That's when you can really create the greatest change. The business communities, the industries that haven't been necessarily there for you. Getting the other voluntary organizations that have aligned goals and aligned aims. This is not only more efficient and effective, it creates a critical mass, which can then move you into our fourth step, which is policy advocacy. You need a critical mass and many voices, and especially well-placed voices, especially in those kinds of places where the representation is perhaps very conservative or not of the political bent that would ordinarily represent this point of view. But if you can have people there and programs there that succeed, that show that change matters, that's when you can get the vote that you need to tip the balance. And right now, when we're counting those votes so carefully in every single House of Congress or every single legislative house, and the count matters, every vote that you can change matters to a great deal. And so we have all become very cognizant that we have to show, especially in those pivotal places, that this kind of change matters and makes a difference for us. So those are probably the sum of my comments. I just really wanted to reflect on that. Thanks for the opportunity to come and be in front of you today. And I'd be glad to have any questions that you might have now.
So I want to thank both of our speakers, but I also want to thank the audience for showing up. I know that there's an important competing event that the two of you may not be aware of, and that's that the Occupy Wall Street movement is having a march right now to the nation's capital, and we're there in spirit, but not exactly in body. Before the audience asks those questions, I want to just mention, reflect for a moment on something that I read in Robert's bio. As soon as I read it, I started thinking about. We are looking right now for those cost-effective practices that help to really make a change in preventing disease in people's lives. And I remember reading that some of your work, or at least this part of your work, has influenced $20 billion in assets for parks. So I just wonder if you want to say how many lives you think that reaches, and whether that's a cost-effective practice.
Actually, that number is now, I think, 37 billion, but who's counting? In terms of lives, we get this from foundations a lot. We're asked in our reports and in our proposals, how will we measure success? And we speak at conferences, we publish reports, and those are some measures of success. But ultimately, we measure success at the City Project by the smiles on children's faces who play in parks that did not exist before, who have access to a beach that would have been privatized, or who get physical education in school that they didn't have before. So it's harder to measure. In Los Angeles Unified School District, which is now enforcing the PE laws, there are close to 700,000 students. 92% of whom are children of color, 74% are low income, and many of them now have PE and they did not before. If you look at statewide, there's over 1,000 school districts in California. Half of them don't enforce PE laws. I believe there's over 3 million school children in California, so potentially we will impact 1.5 million students who will get PE who did not have it before. If we look at visitors to parks, Griffith Park in LA gets 10 million visitors a year.
Baldwin Hills is bigger than that, so we figured that's 10 million visitors to the park who are benefiting from our work. Los Angeles State Historic Park, Carrillo San Jose State Park will get millions of visitors every year. Across the state, by defining standards as to where park funds should be invested, it's like a MasterCard commercial, an acre of park in downtown LA, $1 million an acre. The number of visitors, 10 million a year. The value of planning in a park, priceless. Also the school construction. I didn't mention this, but from 2000 to 2005, I was the chair of the Los Angeles Unified School District School Bond Citizens Oversight Committee. And it was in that context that we helped raise a total of about $27 billion in local bond funds, plus matching state and federal funds. So this was an instance of people voting to tax themselves to build schools. And we built the first high schools in Los Angeles in over 30 years. And as I say, that's $27 billion in a 10-year period. President Obama has proposed $30 billion for school construction throughout the nation. He is right in principle that that should be done, but $30 billion for the nation is nothing. It was a lot for LA, but across the nation, it's not enough. So again, the potential for national change if school districts across the nation enforce physical education requirements, if school districts across the nation had money to build schools and teach physical education, it would create jobs. If the Civilian Conservation Corps and the National Park Service and the National Forest Service hired at-risk youth and taught them how to be forest rangers, park rangers, gave them lifelong careers, the potential for changing those lives, giving people self-confidence, is immeasurable.
So let's open it up to the audience. Let's get some comments and some thoughts. Diane.
That is an excellent question, absolutely. And again, when we started this work over 10 years ago, it's become a popular term in LA among politicians to say that LA is park poor. It has fewer acres of parks per 1,000 residents compared to any major city in the country. But in 2008, the legislation was passed defining park poor statewide as less than 3 acres of parks per 1,000 residents and defining income poor for purposes of allocating park resource bonds as $47,331 median household income. As I say, that is hugely important to define standards to measure progress and equity and hold public officials accountable. That was done through legislation that Senator Kevin De Leon sponsored. And we worked with him and his staff on those figures. And the 3 acres of parks per 1,000 residents, that's where they drew the line. It could have been higher, it could have been lower. A few years ago, the National Parks and Recreation Association recommended 10 acres of parks per 1,000 residents as the standard. They've backed away from that simply because there are a lot of factors that go into how many acres of parks per 1,000 residents there should be. But 3 acres is way less than that. And the median household income, this really is the way the conversation went. I was in a van and Senator De Leon's staff called and said, we need to come up with an income figure. What should it be? And I said, anything between federal poverty line, which is $20,000 a year, and three times that, which is the median household, the living wage in LA. So anything between 20 and 60. And they said, how about $47,331? I said, that's fine. So it really did happen that way. So you can tinker with the number, exact number, but yes, you can, in principle, do that. And we were able to pick three acres because we had mapped the entire state of California working with Green Info Network. Green Info Network is a nonprofit whose mission is to provide GIS mapping and demographic analysis to other nonprofits. We were able to do that because they had compiled an accurate electronic database for the entire state, on top of which we could then layer demographic analysis based on race, color, or national origin. They're now working on a national database. So in principle, we can extend this. We can prioritize like New York City, Detroit, D.C., Atlanta. So the nine county report that I mentioned, which we published about a month ago, that reflects 10 years of our work. It started with a report we did in 2006 limited to L.A. County. But that was my theory, that if we just took that same analysis of L.A. County in terms of acres of parks per 1,000 residents, race, color, national origin, income level, access to a car, access to school fields, if we just did that same methodology for each of the other nine counties, what would happen? And Seth Strongen is primarily responsible for extending that analysis. But again, that analysis could be replicated for any area in the nation.
So let me ask this other question then. What is Title VI civil rights?
No, I understand. And as I said at the beginning, that was one of our goals, was to explicitly talk about the legal issues here today. 1964 was the landmark civil rights legislation that culminated the drive by Martin Luther King and Thurgood Marshall, the Legal Defense Fund, and the NAACP, the civil rights movement. And LBJ pushed that through and commented at the time that he signed the legislation, I've just lost the South to the Democrats for decades to come. But it had, the title is basically the chapters of that civil rights law.
I meant specifically, you were talking about 5 and 6.
Title six is the provision that basically says, it's very short, any recipient of federal funding is prohibited from engaging in intentional discrimination under the statute. And then under the regulations that every agency has adopted, it's also prohibited from engaging in unjustified discriminatory impacts. That is, that statute and those regulations have been the legal framework for our work for many years. And it started before the park work from 94 through 96. I was an attorney on what's now called the MTA case, or the bus riders case. In 94, we filed a lawsuit against the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Transportation Authority, alleging that they operated in separate and unequal bus and rail systems that discriminated against low-income people of color, and we did it under Title VI. In 96, MTA signed an agreement, settlement agreement, to invest over $2 billion to improve the bus system, keep bus fares low, and to do it for 10 years. That's the largest civil rights settlement ever in terms of the dollar value of the settlement. And it was the same framework of equal access to public resources. It's a very little known and little used provision of the Civil Rights Act. There are very few attorneys who know it and use it, but it's a very powerful tool.
Some other thoughts or comments?
Full disclosure, I work with Robert. This is not a ringer question. It's for anyone on the panel, but also for anyone in the room. George, you spoke about the pyramid and thinking about preventive care and avoiding people getting to the situation where they need to be treated for acute conditions. And when I, one of the challenges that I find in our work is when we step outside of the APHA conference or the proverbial choir room. You know, people say parks are great, but that's a luxury, and in this day and age, it's economic hard times, we just can't afford stuff like that. And, you know, my argument back is that, in fact, that's a great investment, because if you think of the health benefits, you know, the cost savings, the cost-to-benefit ratio is tremendously in favor of the benefits, I think. So I'm just curious if anyone on the panel or in the room has insights of how we can sort of move that perspective forward or reframe the conversation about public resources to, you know, physical activity is health. I mean, this is preventive care, this is health care, and this is in our financial best interest outside of, you know, our personal best interest.
Seth, if you were at the opening session, one of the keynote speakers was the director of the National Park Service. And I think he made an excellent case as to why parks were important, not only to help, but to the benefit of American society. You can go down a list of relieving stress and giving opportunity for people to learn more about nature and so on and so forth, and many, and just the open space and the replenishing of natural resources for the balance of nature and the ecology and the environment. But there is a long list, and really the burden of proof needs to be on the person who is discounting parks, because in fact they've not only been adopted, in fact the very first national parks were established under a Republican administration, Teddy Roosevelt, and it's a deeply held value of that party to support parks, national parks, and preserve that opportunity for people to go to parks. So again, I have to shift that burden of proof back to the others, and also say that the industries that are other than health, that have health co-benefits, also have some responsibility of finding evidence for their value to American society, because in this economy, they're all getting cut and they're all under siege, and so they're all needing to come up with a rationale. We're cost-effective because of this, or our value is because of that, or this is what impact we have. And health happens to be a very, very powerful seller. Health makes a difference, and in fact, the environmental people in California tell us that they have gone forward with the green argument for a long, long time, and even climate change, and going forward and saying, this is what's going to happen with climate change. That didn't win. What won is when they started talking about these are the health impacts if you invest in environment, and preserving the environment, and air quality, all of these measures that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. When they brought health in, that made the day, because then people who could see their own benefit to myself or my family's health would be compromised otherwise, that's when they started to care. So health is a very powerful currency. But all of the other realms also have evidence on their behalf, too.
Are there any other questions or comments, Carol?
Back to the Park Poor Index. I'm wondering about what things you've learned that could help this work go to scale. And it seems to me one of them might be coming up with a Park Poor Index software that can be imported into dashboards that are being created all over the place right now. So we can begin to add that to our repertoire of tools for looking at the relationship of this space standard called Park Index to health and begin integrating it in our health equity reports. But I think it would be very powerful. Anything visual like that is a real winner, especially when you've got elected officials tied to the land.
I think that's a brilliant idea. We agree with you 100%. And one use of the Park Poor Income Poor Standard in California is the California Department of Parks and Recreation does publish a tool online. So if you're applying for funds under that proposition, you have to use it and give the park, acres of parks per 1,000 residents figure and the income figure to have a third layer there of a health index. That's a brilliant idea. It's doable with you and Carmen and George and I doing a proposal for Google. Google would be in a great position to implement that.
And why don't we pilot it in the California Public Health Leadership Institute?
That's a great idea. That's a great idea.
All right.
Kind of a related comment. You know, I know the endowment is, I guess, the third largest healthcare foundation in the country. And I know that the endowment actually loves to do partnerships, if you will. And at the same time, Robert was talking about the, so far, the inability to get the national foundations, if you will, engaged. And I think this Park Poor concept, as well as other related concepts, would be powerful concepts because it talks about replicability.
Yeah.
And I think that's what national foundations like to hear. And I know that RWJ has done any number of collaborations, if you will, with the endowment in the recent past. It seems to me that the endowment and its dollars, it's already given, the city project could leverage those in a multiple way.
So, So before this group breaks up, one of the things I want to just throw out to the audience is who should be at the table? What groups do you think should be engaged really actively to get involved for submission of a special session for next year's APHA meeting that will be held in San Francisco?
I think we need to have something in the civil rights legal, you know, just like we had Parks and Recreation today. We need some aspect of this, whether Robert can get himself representing that group, might even be better since you're an actor in this, you know, a stakeholder in this movement as a cutting edge case, that someone that represents that would be very important, I would think. Because we need to go to scale within the field.
Right.
The field.
Right.
Who else? Thoughts from the audience. Yeah.
One thing I'd like to, or one sector I'd like to hear more from is economists.
Of course.
We have a Tacoma Pierce County area, south of Seattle, Washington, uh-huh. and we have Earth Economics, uh-huh. and they are amazing.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that we've been working on with them, I'm from a local health department, we're trying to integrate economic impact data into our indicators project, our indicator reports. And our measure actually of parks is number of people living within half mile of the park. Our community members came up with that. They're awesome. But one of the things I'd like to ask the panel is given our economic structure that we have in the world and our country today, how do we get to equity? I see that as a major barrier, and then also a divisiveness issue. You know, how do we unify people? So to me, those are the two big barriers in my mind in terms of getting equity, the economic structure of our country, and then the divisiveness going on.
You know what, it's so big. It's so big that I think that it would be a great part of an in-depth session next year. Is some regional conversations about this, like where is the conversation, what quality of dialogue, what's going on, and begin to sort of harvest it. I mean, I think it's a big issue up here, and probably too late to address it at 2:00, but I think it's really a good discussion topic. Where else do we get a chance to talk like this with each other and be stimulated by you? You know?
And there's a book coming out called What's the Economy For Anyway? And one of the co-authors is David Batko from Earth Economics, and he might be a good speaker to sort of raise these questions. And they're promoting this thing called the Happiness Survey.
Mm-hmm. And the Happiness Project.
Well, in Potomac, it's the gross national happiness instead of the gross domestic product as a measure of progress. So they're just different issues, they're related, I think.
Yeah, I think that there really is an opportunity to do some. When you plan a special session, there are a whole series of sort of think tanky meetings that you have to pull together in order to get a proposal that's meaty enough that the committee that puts together the special sessions will, you know, yeah, no problem, exactly. I'm seeing
no problem here. No. We can do this.
Yes, I'm sorry, please.
Particular, will the community become stewards of that place? We have communities where they've boarded up their parks. They've actually put up higher fences with barbed wire around them to keep gangs and drug dealers from going in and using that space and intimidating the rest of the community, because the community didn't have the ability to go in and patrol it. It wasn't well lit. The police didn't have the manpower to continue to patrol the area. So it became a dangerous spot, and it is that way. And that's in Oakland, as a matter of fact. So it's not a far away or an unknown place. So the reality is there's a job, a very, very important job to do about community taking ownership and stewardship of places that change. And parks are an important place to have. The community has to care enough to make it theirs and not become a drag on the health.
Well, I think also, you know, and in Oakland, where I live, there is a very good example of the community taking back the park from the drug dealers and the drug addicts and other people that were perpetrating a crime in their community. And the mothers just got in and said, "We're doing it." And I'm the one right by La Clinica that when you were working there, Gail, that it was a very dangerous place. And while I was working there, it started to really turn around. But it really does. The community has to see value. And, you know, that's part of the mobilization effort that I think that we all recognize needs to happen for communities to care enough about each other that they can cause change to happen, care enough and feel connected to. And this is one of the tools that we might be using. So it looks like the next group is maybe starting to gather for the next session. But I want to thank everybody.